Hello, I'm Earl Fontenelle, and you're listening to The Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast, online at schwepp.net. Episode 217. Three Ancient Sages on East Roman Magical Books. Well, gentle listeners, we are about to leave the East Roman realm and head into the 8th century to spend some time sifting the evidence for early esoteric Islam. But before we say farewell to Constantinople and her empire for a while, I wanted to have a look at the state of play with magic in the East Roman realm. Listeners who caught our special episodes on the esoteric Constantinople will already be hip to the fact that the East Romans lived in a very magical world, by nearly any definition. Their lives were populated by saints who could intervene in everyday life, and were often filled with materials through which the powers of those saints might be channeled into manifestation. Similarly with angels. But even if we want to classify everything identifiably Christian as being religion, not magic, even stuff like erotic magic or practices for healing involving talismanic icons, or other genres which are very commonly discussed under the heading magic, let's rule all of that stuff out because it's blatantly Christian. The Constantinopolitans, as we saw in those special episodes on Constantinople, also thought that a number of pre-Christian statues adorning their city were inhabited by stihia, which in this context can be translated as occult powers, which did things like protect the city, make the city's horses behave themselves, purify the water in the drinking cisterns, suppress mosquitoes and other biting insects, and so on. Now, that might be conceived of as a kind of magia naturalis, natural magic, to use a later Latin conceptualization. But anyway, it's some kind of magic, right? And it was thought to be everywhere in the East Roman capital. Now, if it was there in the capital, what about the empire as a whole? Yes, it turns out that East Rome, as a cultural whole, had a very lively magical culture. And we shall be encountering many examples of this as the podcast progresses. However, here I think we should address the question of how the East Romans themselves defined what magic was, as opposed to what religion was. Because, as we pointed out way back in episode 5, one man's heinous sorcery is another man's pious prayer. And as historians, we need to be careful not to overwrite what the East Romans thought magic was. And they literally used the word magia, so we can say that they did indeed have a concept of magic. We don't want to overwrite that with our idea of what magic is. So this is a cautionary preamble before we get to our magic books. Alicia Walker makes some good points in this connection, which I shall quote here. Quote, "As in the West, church authorities played a significant part not only in the social approval and rejection of magic, but also in the very definition of what magic was. The specific natures of different magical endeavors varied greatly from one another, and judgment regarding whether a particular activity was acceptable to Christian orthodoxy could change over time. A consistent defining element for occult practices across the Middle Byzantine period was the belief that such endeavors involved the marshalling of supernatural powers outside of ecclesiastical authority and rituals. Extra-institutional and extra-liturgical activities and devices might employ Christian imagery and language, but they did so in a manner not sanctioned by the church. Occult traditions can also be distinguished in relation to class, with individuals of lower social echelons typically being associated with what might be labeled as superstitious activities transmitted through popular practice and oral tradition, whereas educated people engaged in the exploration of more esoteric, book-based occult knowledge. Such distinctions were by no means absolute, however, as indicated by certain practices, for example, the use of amulets, and beliefs in, for example, the supernatural power of antique statues that are evident across the social spectrum of medieval Byzantium," end of quote. Now, in this episode, we are specifically going to be looking at that more esoteric book-based occult knowledge. And the materials we're going to be looking at were all transmitted right through the Middle Ages at the heart of Orthodoxy, So they represent a very interesting outlying case. A lot of the magic of the East Roman realm, as we shall see again and again, and a lot of these practices even survive till today in Greece, a lot of this stuff is working with saints. And it might be a bit on the fringes of what the church deals with, but it's still very much within a Christian belief system. The books we're going to talk about today have a much more dubious relationship with Christianity or Orthodoxy. Now, the point I think Walker's making here that we should pay attention to as we move forward in the podcast is that we're going to need to strictly attend to the particular definition of magic in a given situation in East Roman society. And this goes for in history more generally. Already in the podcast, we've seen authors like Apuleius and Iamblichus actively arguing with commonly held notions of what magic, magia, or goetia is, and redrawing the boundaries in startling ways. And we're going to see a lot more of this sort of thing as the podcast goes on. But the reason I wanted to make this episode is to discuss a few very important examples of the more esoteric book-based occult knowledge that Walker's alluding to. East Roman magical books, which play an outsized role in the history of Western esotericism. Now, each of these books has a long and very complicated history as books. They're not only reliant on magical traditions, which go way back, they are, in the forms in which the East Romans read them and in which we sometimes have them now, stitched together from heterogeneous texts, often a mix of very old and brand spanking new. In this episode, we're not going to get into the complicated textual questions too much. Now, is that a sigh of relief I hear, or is it a dismal, oh man, echoing through the ether? Well, either way, for the hardcore few who like that sort of thing, don't worry. Each of these three works discussed in this episode will receive its very own story time episode, in which we shall go through the texts with the fine-toothed comb of a keen interest in what's in these books as they stand. What kinds of magic are we talking about? What herbs cure what diseases? Who are the angels in question? What about the demons? And wait a minute, did you just say you can use the blood of a bat as magical ink? All that good stuff. And a fine-toothed comb of Quellenkritik. That's the fancy German name for the art of figuring out what source texts were cobbled together to form a given text. But in this episode, I propose precisely a useful summary. We'll discuss each work, what it's about, give a brief discussion of its sphere of influence in the broader Western esoteric milieu, and just move on. So hopefully this will be helpful to lay people, but also to academic students of the history of magic, because it's remarkably difficult to access a straightforward account of the origins of the three books we're going to discuss today, even in scholarly sources. This is partly because they're not really straightforward texts at all, but it's also seemingly partly because while non-specialists have just been repeating weird garbled errors for hundreds of years without stopping to figure out what's actually in these books, the Wikipedia articles are pretty much unusable, for example, full of errors and also incomplete. Meanwhile, the specialists haven't really bothered to make the effort we're making today, namely the effort of representing these books in an accurate but somewhat straightforward way. Of course, we have the luxury that a lot of scholars publishing don't have, which is to go back and do storytime episodes to cover all the stuff we missed out. But there it is. Now on with the show. The three books in question traveled under three names, which will be very familiar to lovers of the Western esoteric traditions. These are pseudo-authors, the folks who are meant to have written these texts, and whose names are meant to give these texts that special sauce of arcane ancient wisdom. I refer, of course, to Hermes Trismegistus, for it is he. Apollonius of Tyana, for it is he as well. And last but not least, King Solomon, for it is his Royal Highness. King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Conquering Lion of Judah. We will begin with Hermes and his highly influential book, The Chiranides. Listeners may recall that way back around episode 100, when we were discussing the Hermetic traditions in antiquity, we referred to a distinction often drawn in scholarship between so-called technical Hermetica and theoretical Hermetica. The theoretical sometimes known as the philosophical hermetica, are the type of things found in the Corpus Hermeticum and in many of the Stobaean hermetic texts. While the technical, also known as practical hermetica, are practical manuals for doing stuff, things like the seminal ancient astrological text, which we know had its origin in Hellenistic Egypt, and which for lack of a proper title is known to historians of astrology as the astrological Hermes texts. We don't have that Hermes text, but we know the type of thing that was in it from later astrologers who cite it. If we want an example of a technical hermetic text which does survive, kinda, from antiquity, the most important is undoubtedly the Chiranides, the text we're going to discuss now. To quote Garth Fodin, quote, "By the hermetic occult literature, we effectively mean the Chiranides, which deal in exhaustive detail with the sympathies, antipathies, and other occult properties of birds, fishes, plants, and stones. In the form in which we have it, the Chiranides is a compilation from several earlier treatises, mostly hermetic, but one of them goes under the name of Harpocration of Alexandria, who must have flourished about the middle of the 2nd century AD, and is quoted in the prologue of the Chiranides as describing an inscription, quote, within a quote, carved in Syrian characters, end of quote, within a quote, which he saw and had translated for him at Alexandria in Babylon, end of quote. So, here we are, hermetic wisdom inscribed on stelae. Incidentally, that technical versus theoretical distinction in the Hermetica is fundamentally bollocks, as we tried to emphasize in those earlier Hermetica episodes, and Fodin actually goes on to use precisely our text, the Chiranides, to illustrate this point. Yes, it is a practical work on what you might call medical magic, mostly medical, but it's full of the theory of correspondences, theological ideas, and more. So it's telling you how to do stuff, but there is a theory behind it, how it all works, which is very thought out and which is sometimes made explicit. So all of the practical hermetica have some theoretical in them, and a lot of the theoretical have little touches of the practical in them. Now, the book known as something like Chiranides in ancient Greek, or Chiranides in a more modern pronunciation, is transcribed into Latin with a C instead of a K, which probably means that a lot of our listeners will, if they've heard of this book, think of it and pronounce it as the Chiranides, which is fine. This could be seen as the native English pronunciation. I'm going to call it Chiranides, which is at least no more wrong than any of the 10 other ways of pronouncing it. This book is indeed a composite of a number of earlier works, many of them hermetic in the sense of claiming to be by Hermes or one of his students, with the added bonus, also seen, for example, in the hermetic text Kore Kosmu, which we've discussed on the podcast, the added bonus of claiming to be a translation of a text inscribed by Hermes upon a stela. Though in this case, the first book of the Chiranides claims the prestige target language not the usual Egyptian hieroglyphics, but the deeper cut of Syrian characters. And then later, in the second to fourth books, we get a Persian stela mentioned. So there, the Chiranides, as we have it, is a composite text based on two different primordial inscribed stelae in two different languages. Now, the name Chiranides doesn't mean anything, and hence it exists not only in a bunch of different pronunciations, but also in a range of spellings across the manuscript tradition. Like the hermetic Poimandres, it is on the face of it a meaningless word, but one with suggestive possibilities, so there's no end of scholarly theories out there. The textual history of this book is insane, and we're going to skip it. The Chiranides is a confusing, messy work, and this is because it's made up of two main books that were stitched together by an unnamed East Roman editor sometime between probably the 4th and 8th centuries. At any rate, Georgios Sinkelos, writing in the year 806, refers to the composite Chiranides as we know and love it, so we know it was put together as a text before that time. And there isn't so much more to say about it in a summary way than what Foden has already told us. It's a collection of lists, and because it's composite, the form the lists take differ between the first book and the books 2 to 4, but roughly speaking, the occult properties of plants, animals, and stones, what kind of curative uses you can make out of them, what kind of talismans you can make that combine a plant, stone, an animal to make a healing talisman or a protective amulet to cure or prevent diseases, and then the occasional extra bit of talismanic amulet making. That's our text for what's in it, including the secret acrostic poems in the text, the hermetic text interwoven with other works and more. See our storytime episode. We'll also get into some of the specifics of the remedies, occult properties, and the whole medical magical thinking behind the text there. But now let's turn to the book's significance for Western esotericism. This book is, as indicated by that Foden quote we read earlier, the best surviving example of the practical hermetic manuals, which we know flourished in antiquity. And it went on to have an enormous influence in later Western esoteric traditions. We know, first of all, that it was very influential at Constantinople and in the Eastern realm more broadly, right through to the Palaiologan period. That's right up to the fall of Constantinople in 1453. But we also know that parts of it were translated into Syriac, into Arabic in the 9th century as part of the mass translation movement of Greek into Arabic, and influenced the burgeoning occult properties medical literature in those languages. We also know that it was translated into Latin, interestingly, in the 12th century, if not earlier, and thus went on to influence matters medico-magical in Western Europe. It shows up, for example, or knowledge of it shows up, for example, in the occult properties manual attributed to Albert the Great, sometimes called The Little Albert. This book, the Kiranides, is in short pretty much everywhere in the West in esoteric circles. Now, its status was dicey in the medieval period going forward. I'm not familiar with the evidence in Islam, but my guess would be no one had a particular problem with it. At any rate, vis-a-vis Christendom, on the one hand, there's certainly nothing explicitly demonic in the recipes in the Kiranides, which can pretty comfortably be categorized as natural magic, or even one could argue a kind of science or attempted science, since natural properties are seen as entirely responsible for the effects the book claims for its recipes. Although that might be stretching the meaning of what we mean by natural. I mean, part of what is natural to the mindset of the Kiranides is connections with gods and goddesses, right? On the other hand, the Kiranides is also clearly non-Abrahamic. It freely attributes god and goddess associations to some of the substances it names, as I just mentioned. And moreover, its recipes just kind of smell magical. Just as modern scholars, when attempting to define the field of magic, often resort to answering the question, what is magic, by saying, well, does it look like magic? In the same way as a music critic would answer the question, you know, how do you know it's jazz, by saying, well, it sounds like jazz, right? Well, the church authorities at Constantinople would recognize jazz too, or rather they had a nose for magic too. And when they noticed this book, they did not like it. We moderns, or we scholars of magic, might ask what the essential difference is between, say, a miniature saint's icon worn around the neck to drive off a specific disease, and an amulet made of various plant materials and a bit of a special stone to drive off a disease. But to East Roman churchmen, certain churchmen anyway, this difference was pretty obvious. There's a great anecdote from the 14th century, when the Eastern realm was in the midst of its largest outbreak of public heresy hunting. They never went inquisitional, as Western Europe was doing at this same period, but they did have a somewhat parallel freakout in the 14th century. And in the year 1371, an ecclesiastical court at Constantinople, convening in the Hagia Sophia, ended up busting what I can only call a ring of magical book pushers, among whose forbidden wares was found the Kiranides, a book famous for its impiety, according to a contemporary source. And the book was eventually thrown at Demetrios Chloros, a high-ranking churchman of dangerous tastes in both theology and occult literature and sciences. And by the book, I don't mean the Kyrenides, I mean they threw the book at him. Check out the delightful short article by Cumon for the details of that case. But that's just one episode in the long reception history of the Kyrenides, which I just couldn't leave out because it's too good. One of Hermes Trismegistus's less read works, and that's to whet your appetite for more. We shall encounter this book again as the podcast progresses, from Isfahan to Paris and beyond. Now let us turn to the Book of Wisdom of Apollonius of Tyana. Our second important magical book is the Book of Wisdom and of the Science of Talismans of Apollonius of Tyana, sometimes known as the Apotelesmata or Apotelesmata of Apollonius, dating probably to some time in the 5th to 6th centuries, but this dating is really an educated guess. We actually know that some of the sources of this work, like the so-called Horarium, go back many centuries earlier than this, but our text as we have it is maybe 5th to 6th century, not too far off where the podcast is now, actually. What are a few hundred hypothetical years between friends, right? So before we say a few more words about what's in this text, let me just say that the various Greek manuscripts of this work have not even been collated into a single edition. And of the three partial editions out there, I've personally only been able to consult one, the one edited by Boll in the 7th volume of the CCAG, or Catalogus Codicum Astrologorum Graecorum. So we'll be basing what follows on that version, but my understanding is the versions don't really differ all that much one from the other. Now, what's this book about? To get a basic lock on our text as it survives in Greek, it's not too long, only about 6 pages of closely printed Greek in the CCAG edition, we can turn to David Pingree for a summary. This is a quote slightly adapted. The Biblos Sophias, Book of Wisdom, is found in fragmentary form in a handful of Greek codices, of which the earliest was copied in the late 15th century, and in a more complete Arabic version, the Kitab al-Talasim al-Akbar, or Very Large Book of Talismans. The Arabic version of the Book of Wisdom contains stories of the talismans constructed by Apollonius, similar to those which are recounted in numerous Greek writings, especially John Malalas's, from the 5th century on. The Greek original of the Book of Wisdom was perhaps composed in that century or the next. It contains lists of angels with Semitic-sounding names, of the 24 hours, the weekdays, and the seasons, as well as the names of numerous other time-independent angels. The angels of 4 of the weekdays are the archangels Michael, Uriel, Gabriel, and Raphael, whose presence connects the Book of Wisdom, perhaps indirectly, with Jewish Kabbalistic circles. Also given are the secret names of the seasons, and of the sun, the moon, heaven, earth, the sea, and the 4 directions. Each of these has a different name in each of the 4 seasons. Prayers are to be addressed to these angels, and talismans constructed that allow the magician to utilize their power. But further details are missing from the Greek. Presumably, an examination of the manuscripts of the longer Arabic version will reveal more of the techniques utilized by this false Apollonius. End of quote. Right, that is a great summary, but I want to pull on a few threads raised by Pingree and expand on him. First of all, let's just re-summarize our summary. This is an incomplete work as it stands in Greek. It gives us lots of angel names associated with seasons, days, and hours within the day and the night, but it doesn't give us practically any information about what to do with those angel names. In the next book we'll be discussing today, the Solomonic Magical Treatise, we do get information on what to do with those angel names. You make talismans, and here's how. You also do special prayers. No one, I think, knows why the Greek text has had its instructions removed, but the obvious hypothesis is that some Christian copyist, and this might have been the same Christian copyist who inserted some rather ill-fitting Christian material into the text, which really gives the game away vis-a-vis the authorship, because there's no way Apollonius of Tyana was especially interested in the salvific coming of Jesus. maybe this copyist or some other copyist just removed the ritual material, finding it somehow scary or beyond what could rightly be copied or disseminated. At any rate, we don't know, but that is the text that we have. Second of all, some housekeeping. Pingree speaks of, quote, Jewish Kabbalistic circles, end of quote. Now, just to be clear, there were no Jewish Kabbalistic circles in the 5th to 6th centuries. It's not entirely clear that the Sefer Yetzirah had even been written at this stage, but certainly the Zohar had not been written at this stage. So it really doesn't make sense to speak of Kabbalah at this phase in history in the way that scholars of Kabbalah understand the term, as a specific set of esoteric Jewish traditions arising historically in Spain in the High Middle Ages. That being said, I assume that what Pingree is referring to here are the Jewish circles engaged in this period with A, the kinds of magical operations as preserved in the Sefer HaRazim, see episode 146 of the show, B, the kinds of magico-spiritual operations preserved in the Hechelot and Merkava texts, and C, reading Solomonic texts of the type adumbrated by the Testament of Solomon, see episodes 150 and 151. All of these kinds of literature are evidence for profoundly oogly-boogly currents of Judaism in our period, and indeed for centuries before our period. We can't quite date the Hechelot texts, certainly, but I personally think they were probably around, or something like them was around by the 6th century. But the Sefer HaRazim and the Testament of Solomon were definitely around at this stage. So I think Pingree's just being a bit loose with the term Kabbalah, as so often happens. It is all too common for non-specialists to back-project the medieval label of Kabbalah onto anything in earlier Judaism which seems either mystical or magical or both. And of course, Kabbalists themselves do this all the time, because for them, the tradition goes back to Moses. Here on the Schwepp, we are, you know, boringly historicist, so we don't want to talk about Kabbalists in the 6th century. But setting aside the term Kabbalah, Pingree makes a great point. The Jewish connection is relevant because this text, the Book of Wisdom of Apollonius of Tyana, on whom, see episode 65, but also in the present connection, see our special episodes on talismanic Constantinople, where Apollonius does a lot of talismanic statue making. This text is not really the sort of thing we would expect from Apollonius of Tyana if we were classicists who had read his life by Philostratos, or even the traditions relating to him in authors like Malelas. He appears indeed going around making talismans, but very much a Hellenic-style wonder-working sage whose powers lie in his mastery of Pythagorean philosophy. None of this angel stuff. It's occult properties, mastery of silence, mastery of the numerical underpinnings of reality, that sort of thing. The Book of Wisdom, rather, has its roots somewhere in the Jewish, and presumably Jewish-Christian, angelological traditions, without anything particularly Pythagorean about it. However, Apollonius has become, in this period, as evidenced by Malelas, the authority on making talismans, full stop. So any work on talisman making, quite naturally, can travel under his name, be it ever so Jewish or Jewish-Christian. And this is basically what has happened here. An educated guess is that whoever put this work together in the form we have it just made the connection talismans, Apollonius, and thus a legend was born. Apollonius has become, in fact, quite Abrahamic in this text, and in future appearances on the podcast, we shall see both Apollonii. Apollonius, the Pythagorean talisman maker who works along natural magical occult properties lines, usually with some astrology in the mix, and the more Abrahamic or even Solomonic, we might say, Apollonius, who deals with the unseen world of angels, demons, and sometimes jinn, and knows how to command them, usually also with an aim to making talismans. But the point is, do you make talismans based on occult properties simpliciter, or do you make talismans based on getting angels, jinn, and demons to do your bidding? Thirdly,
this quotation from Pingree
is from an article entitled Some of the Sources of the Rayat al-Hakim.
Now, the Rayat is an extremely influential Arabic magical compendium, which went on to be translated into Latin under the title Picatrix. One of the most important magical manuals of the Middle Ages in the Far West. The fact that the Bibliosophias is indeed a major source for the Rayat is already reason enough to include it in any study of the history of Western esotericism, but its interest, in fact, goes beyond that. And this is because, fourth of all, Pingri, writing in 1980, alludes to a fuller Arabic translation of the Bibliosophias, which survives in extenso, and suggests that, quote, an examination of the manuscripts of the longer Arabic version will reveal more of the techniques utilized by this false Apollonius, end of quote. Well, it's now more than 40 years on, so obviously there will not have only have been such a study of the Arabic manual, Kitab al-Tala Sim al-Akbar, but also a proper edition of the Greek, taking into account all the manuscripts, and comparative philological work considering the two textual traditions side by side. Right? Wrong, gentle listener. As far as I can tell, nothing has been done on this important work in the interim period. The Arabic text hasn't even been printed, much less edited, to my knowledge, and to the knowledge of my informants. And in short, there is a super juicy PhD project here for a Greco-Arabist. Maybe someone has done this work, or is working on it right now. If so, please get in touch. But if so, I have missed it. As far as I can tell, there isn't even an English translation of the Greek, but we can at least take care of that when we get to the Storytime episode examining this text in more detail. In terms of the details of what's in the text, we can't go too far beyond Pingree's summary here for reasons of time. The book starts out with an introduction telling us that this was taught by Apollonius to his student Sustumos Thalassos, and the work is addressed to him in the second person. It's worth checking out the intro because it's great. It shows us the writer immediately setting the book up as esoteric wisdom. Quote, "Hear me, my son," says Apollonius, "and I shall make clear to you the mysteries of wisdom, unknown, unkenned, and hidden from the many. On the opportune moments, Chiron," that's the technical term known from astrology, "and times of the hours of the day and night, also of their names and powers, and of the veritable wisdom hidden within them. And I shall reveal to you the apotelesmata from the knowledge, gnosios," that's gnosis, "given to me by God, as to how all things that God made upon the earth are arranged," end of quote. Now, I haven't translated apotelesmata here. I think it means talismans, but we can't really get into this crucial bit of vocabulary here because of time constraints. We'll get back to it. Now, because this is an East Roman book, one suspects the term stichiuntai, or stichiunte, not to mean be arranged, fall in line with, as we find it in Lampe's patristic lexicon, so much as to mean have or exhibit occult properties. Our Constantinople episodes for more on the stichia as precisely being the occult properties of talismanic statues. So that's what he's saying. I'm going to reveal to you not only the sort of occult properties of different times of day and night, and the sort of wisdom, the secret names of things. I should also reveal to you the talismans that God showed me, and how all the things that God made upon the earth have occult properties. This is kind of what he's getting at, I think. The text then goes on and basically consists of a clearly mutilated work outlining a mix of astrological considerations to do with planetary hours and such like, with angel lists. And the angel names are full of delights. Some are the usual pseudo-Hebrew names ending in L, such as we find all over from the Greek magical papyri to Arabic and Latin high magical works. But others are more in line of, well, voces magicae. Some, like the ever-popular Abrasax, are well-known deities from the magical culture of late antiquity. There are obvious insertions to make things seem more Christian, but you can actually see the seams where a Christian scribe just dropped this material in. However, as Pingree says, the promised secrets of making the talismans never quite show up. We're given a lot of useful background, I guess you'd say, but we don't quite know what to do with it all. When the time comes, hopefully we can cover the Arabic version and get to that material. And unfortunately, there's no time to go into the work's alternate title, about Telesmata, or its extraordinary links to Jewish and Christian literature like the Testament of Adam, but we'll come back to those matters and more in the Storytime episode. This brings us to the Book of Wisdom's Nachleben in Western esotericism, it's afterlife, and here we are looking of a bunch of streams of influence. So one stream of influence we've already mentioned, that's the Ghayat al-Hakim, the Goal of the Sage, one of the most important magical books of the Arabic tradition from the 10th or maybe 11th century down to the present day, which incorporates, among many other sources, the Kitab al-Talasim al-Akbar. The Ghayat is a long, very involved miscellany, manual for a fully astralized art of talisman making, which includes lots of other magical goodies as well. We have also mentioned the Picatrix, a Latin language version of the Ghayat, composed sometime in the 13th century, and thereafter gaining an unsavory reputation, but also a rabid fandom in Western Europe. I think if we had to award a prize for the most influential grimoire in the history of Latinate esotericism, the Picatrix might win the prize. So there will be much more to say about this text as the podcast progresses. But what about our Book of Wisdom in its own form? Not as a source, but, you know, as a book, both in Greek and in Arabic. Here, much more research is urgently needed. We know it circulated in Arabic as a talisman-making manual, on a much less ambitious scale than the Ghayat, and we know that a rather chopped-up version survived in Greek right through the East Roman period. But who was reading it? What was its significance as a book in its own right? When did it get chopped up? Who did the chopping? These are all, as far as I can tell, unanswered questions in the current state of research, gentle listener. It may be that, as often happened, the Greek version pretty much stayed put in Rome, while the Arabic version is the one that went out into the wider world to influence magic more broadly. There's a third stream of influence, or a third way that this book plays a role in the story of the magical manuals of the Western first millennium and beyond, and this is part of a broader story that looks less like a series of rivers flowing into each other and more like a total confusion of textual streams flowing back and forth into each other, like a muddy Nile Delta, right? As we've touched upon, the Book of Wisdom is also known as the Apotelesmata of Apollonius, which for our purposes means talismans. It is thus part of a larger genre of talismanic works, whose roots lie in late antiquity, but whose true flowering comes in the Islamicate development of high astrological talismanic manuals, sometimes bringing in geomancy and magic squares and a whole bunch of other occult sciences, even alchemy. It is also part of the story of how specific angel magic practices evolved. We saw in the Testament of Solomon already some concern with the importance of knowing which angels and potentially which demons pertain to which times of day, to which places in the body, and so on. Well, this book, the Biblos Sophias, is an early technical manual giving some instructions for how to make use of those angelic and demonic correspondences. And this kind of magical theory and practice is a major part of the medieval Western magical canon going forward. Arabic, Latin, Syriac, Jewish, you name it. The story of the Book of Wisdom is also part of the story, the next book on our agenda, sometimes known as the Apotelesmatiki Pragmatea tu Solomontus, the Talismanic Working of Solomon. So in alternate title terms, they have the same name, but one is attributed to Apollonius, one to Solomon. For one thing, both Solomon's work and Apollonius's work partake of the Horarium tradition, which links them to all manner of Christian paracanonical writings like the Syriac Testament of Adam, which was translated into countless languages. And for another thing, both the Book of Wisdom and the Solomonic text are angelological stroke astrological manuals for constructing talismans. Different works, but with the same general characterization, right? Now, lots more research is needed here, and we should also look into the story of this text as it appears in the manuscripts, because it sometimes travels along with both the Kirenides and with our Solomonic work, and sometimes with the Testament of Solomon, and probably with lots of other interesting neighbors that I haven't yet got my head around. More to come on that. But what is this Solomonic work I keep alluding to anyway? I refer, of course, to our third book, the Apotelesmatiki Pragmatia tu Solomontos, also known as the Hygromantia or Hygromanteia. This is a work which is a prime example of the problem with studying magical texts. They refuse to sit still. We encountered this problem first on the podcast, I think, when looking at the Hechelot and Merkava traditions. Peter Schaefer and his colleagues turned the keen eye of German philological exactitude onto this mass of texts, the Hechelot texts, and eventually just threw up their hands and said, the idea of a critical edition is a category error with this kind of literature. All you have are variants. There is no original text. Now, this, of course, is true of every text, but it's a case of degree, right? The amount of remixing that tends to go on in this magical literature is many degrees greater than you find in other forms of literature. Nearly every manuscript of our Solomonic work differs radically, such that Marathakis, in his translation intended for English-speaking practitioners in the Source Works of Ceremonial Magic series, put out by Golden Horde Press, simply gives a bunch of different translations of individual manuscript versions, rather than trying to collate anything. Torrijano, in discussing the Hygromanteia in his 2002 study of the esoteric Solomon, emphasizes the same point. This text is text vivant. It refuses to be pinned down such that there's no point in looking for the urtext. So how are we going to talk about this text? Well, since the manuscript titles differ across a wide spectrum, I'm going to first of all call our text the Hygromanteia, partly because this seems to be the title most in use in secondary literature, partly because we can't call it the Solomonic Magical Treatise because there are a lot of those and you need to be specific, and partly because I just like the absurdity of calling this text the Hygromanteia. Why? Well, whatever Hygromantia means, and it literally means water divination or liquid divination, so the name is presumably gesturing towards some form of scrying practiced by gazing into a pool of liquid, practiced with a long pedigree, we see it in the PGM and so on. Whatever Hygromantia means, the practice of Hygromantia is not laid out in the Hygromantia of Solomon. And so that just tickles my magical funny bone, and I think it's a perfect title. Now, in what follows, I shall be speaking of the Hygromantia, but that obviously can't be right based on what has been said already. If there's not even a single basic text, how can we refer to it as a single text or book? There is, in effect, a wide range of versions of a single work, with omissions here and there and inclusions here and there, such that we can speak of a sort of textual family. And it's a reasonably tight-knit family. There's brothers and sisters, there's a few cousins, but for this discussion, we're going to leave out the sort of cousins once removed and the grandnephews and stuff like that. There are a lot of cool outliers to this text, but we're going to ignore them for the purpose of simplification. In our story time episode, we're going to get into it, and it gets cool. So that's our textual nuclear family. It's worth noting that our text often travels in the same manuscripts as the fragments of the Biblos Sophias, as we've already mentioned, also the Kirenides. And sometimes, too, our text is found as a kind of practical appendix to the Testament of Solomon. Again, see episodes 150 and 151. So you've got the Testament of Solomon laying out the story of Solomon and all the demons and angels he used to, he sort of mastered and used to gain wisdom and also used to build the temple. And then you get a practical manual, also by Solomon, according to the text, in which he tells you how to specifically manipulate the powers of those angels and demons. Never mind that the names of angels and demons completely don't match up. This text appears in some really great manuscripts, notably the British Library manuscript Harleianus 5596, which is a lavishly illustrated 15th century volume collecting a bunch of Greek magical materials, You can see an example illustration from that tome in the notes to this episode. And if you're familiar with what's known as the grimoire tradition, the sort of later medieval, early modern Western magical book tradition, like the Keys of Solomon, this will look very familiar to you. And that's not an accident. This family of texts, the Iromantia, are right at the headwaters of that tradition, the Solomonic grimoire tradition. So many terms of later occultism that come from the grimoire tradition can be traced back to this book. Now, how do we date this work? Well, we have 14 manuscripts that preserve the Hygromantea completely or in part. The earliest are 15th century, but the latest are 19th century. That number shows both that this book has been very popular, because 14 manuscripts is a lot for a magical manuscript, and also that it was popular into the 19th century, so we literally had sort of Victorian era magicians hand copying this work. No one can really date this thing. The language used in the Greek clearly points to Christianized East Rome. This is a Byzantine work, in quotes. But beyond that, it's hard to say. Torrijano suggests a kind of later medieval redaction in Italy, which is probably where parts of the text were Christianized, but he also notes a bunch of obviously pre-Christian sources. And some of them he goes so far as to call Hermetic, as in pertaining to the Hermetic technical literature to which the Quiranides also pertains. So in a way, this kind of magical literature is really a microcosm of the West as an intellectual project. It's the fusion of the Hellenic, represented by the Hermes material, and the Abrahamic, represented by the Jewish angelology material. Now, if the Solomonic work of angel and demon summoning mentioned by the 13th century writer Niketas Choniatis in his is the same as this Solomonic work, then we can say it was definitely around by the 12th century, because that's what he is citing, a work that was sort of brought up in a anti-magic trial in the year 1172. But it's even if the work is no earlier than that, it's clear that its roots go much earlier to the same angely, demony, astralized, Hellenized Jewish milieu as the Testament of Solomon, the Bibliosophias, etc. And also probably Hermetic technical literature. So that was all a lot of blather. Let me just summarize. Medieval East Roman magic book based on lots of pre-Christian material, but redacted to heck, probably multiple times and in multiple places. The work is, like the Bibliosophias, all in the second person singular, preserving the conceit that this is a letter from Solomon to his son Rehoboam. Manuscripts that preserve the introductory materials make this explicit, because it's sort of like, my son Rehoboam, let me tell you about the secret wisdom. But some manuscripts drop the introduction such that the practitioner, the reader, is faced with the author Solomon just talking straight to you, right? Saying, do this, do this, do this, right? Now, the book is really complex, much longer and more involved and more messy than the Bibliosophias of Apollonius. But luckily for us, Torrijano has done the work of doing a kind of synthetic breakdown of all the different versions and stuff. And so I'm going to do a kind of oversimplified summary based on his work. What's in the Hygromantia? Keeping in mind that not every version of the text has all the sections I'm about to mention. So first we have an introduction. This is the instruction of Solomon to his son Rehoboam. An exposition of the seven planets and their dominion during every hour of the days of the week. So planetary hours. Angels and demons who rule over every hour of the days of the week. And the names of these angels and demons are, unsurprisingly, a mixture of nomina barbara or, sort of unintelligible, weird, vocis magicae sounding names, pseudo-Hebrew angel names, and classical figures of angelology like Michael, Raphael. And demonology, interestingly. So you have Asmodai, Ornai, etc. Then prayers to the seven planets, a prayer to the angel of each hour, the characteres of each planet. These are planetary sigils, a very familiar graphic element to lovers of the grimoire tradition. Magical material, we'll come back to this in a moment. Another technique, praxis, to summon the spirits. Two different forms of divination, gastromantia and ribact- tauromantia. These are two different methods of divination by using a vessel. Angels and demons of each day, other horoscopes of the day and night, hours of every day of the week, and appropriate actions to be performed in them, the plants of the zodiac, there's a little herbal section at the end, and the plants of the seven planets, more astral herbal lore. Okay, that's done. Now, what about that magical material that we mentioned? There is what Torrijano calls the magical treatise, which is only included in a few of the manuscripts, notably Harleanus 5596, the most complete of all. However, two other manuscripts contain this magical treatise in some form outside the context of the Iromantia. So we have four versions of this so-called magical treatise to work with. Whether it makes sense to refer to it as a treatise on its own or an interesting bit in the middle of the Iromantia that someone decided to just split off and use on its own, I'm not qualified to say, but it's interesting stuff. This section, and I'm going to summarize here what Harleanus 5596 has, really is getting us out of the sort of, in terms of flavor, out of the astrological stroke angelological mode that we've seen so far, and into much more what you think of when you think of a Faust figure conjuring up demons with a circle on the floor, or indeed a member of the Golden Dawn, or another one of those 19th century occult orders doing. So this again starts out with the pseudepigraphical introduction, Solomon talking to his son Rehoboam. Then we get a bunch of instructions for making a bunch of magical materials, tools. Instructions on making a sword. This is known as the sword of art, technis. Instructions to make a small drinking vessel, kondolion. Instructions to make a small scroll, chartion. Instructions on how to write with blood, writing with the blood of a bat, writing with the blood of a swallow, dove, the blood of a bull. Instructions on making a figure out of wax. Instructions for making a figure out of clay. Knowledge of the moment in which it is necessary to attempt some actions. Interpretations about making clothes, himatia. About making garlands, about making the urania, about the ring. And then a little kind of miscellany at the end. If you want to make a princess love you, if you want to find a treasure, another praxis to summon the spirits, and then a repetition. Gestoromantia, Ribactoromantia, angels and demons of each day, another horoscope for the day and night, plants of the seven planets. So there you have it. An interesting, complicated work. And I've probably done a disservice to my plan of trying to make this a useful summary by going through it bit by bit, but I couldn't resist because Torrijano has given us such a lovely breakdown. And it's really kind of cool to see all the weird stuff that would be in a magical miscellany like this. Now, what about the Nachleben of this book? How does it echo out into Western esotericism? Well, this book is, as we said, survives in 15th century or later manuscripts, and we have no hard evidence for it in the East Roman realm, although we do, as I mentioned, have hard evidence for angelological and demonological manuals attributed to Solomon that were used by magicians. Is there an Arabic version? Not that I know of. Torrijano alludes to that there might be one, but further research needed. If anyone knows about the life of this book or lack thereof in Arabic, please get in touch. Now, what else can we say? The entire Western grimoire tradition is influenced by either this text directly or by other texts that also influenced this text, such that you certainly can't talk about Western Solomonic magic without talking about this text in one way or another. And this book, in some manuscripts, calls itself The Key of Solomon and talks about the Sword of Art and a bunch of other stuff that anyone who studies 19th, 18th century occultism and ceremonial magic will initially say, holy cow, like this sounds like something that was being done in, you know, drawing rooms in central London in the Gilded Age. And that's exactly right. That's a transmission of ideas from this text down a long series of adventures, textual adventures, into Latin texts like the Keys of Solomon. There may well be, and I think there probably is, more to say about the Nachleben of this text, some of which I don't know, and some of which we don't have time for. So I'm going to leave it for now. There you have it, gentle listener. Three ancient sages three magical books from East Rome. Some people once suggested that you could study Western esotericism without studying East Roman culture and textual transmission. Huh. Interesting. Anyway, it's time to bid a fond farewell now to the Christian world for a bit, and indeed to the 7th century, and to return to the Islamicate world in the 8th century of our era. Join us next time as we explore the evidence for early Islamicate esotericism, and in the meantime, be like the wisdom of Apollonius of Tyana, that is, unknown, unkenned, and hidden from the many, and stay esoteric.